Colleagues, today we will continue hearing Senate Bill 5505, Department of Corrections Budget, and we're going to have a brief overview from Director Williams and then jump into the Operations Division. So if you would like to tee it up. Or
thank you.
Wilson, did you have any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to finish up sort of the overview portion of the presentation that we began on Thursday. And I thought a good place to start would actually just be on slide number 33 of your presentation materials under the overview section. And I'm going to just briefly touch on the department's key performance measures at this point of the presentation, but rest assured that in each of the divisional presentations, the division that has ownership of that performance measure will go into more detail on those performance measures as we go through their divisional presentation, and then again tying back to those performance measures as much as possible as we move through our policy options packages. I also want to point out that we look forward, I think, at the opportunity perhaps when the budget moves into work session to have a conversation with the committee about some of the measures that we're currently operating with and some recommendations that we might have to adjusting those measures or changing some of the components of those, and would welcome that conversation at the, perhaps the work session stage of the presentation. Our key performance measure number one is Measure 17 compliance. The committee will recall that in 1994, the voters in Oregon passed Measure 17 requiring that inmates either be involved in work or programming for 40 hours a week. And you can see over time as we've moved forward, there have been some challenges, obviously, in achieving that measure. We did, in the 2005 timeframe, raise the target, but even then have had a challenge, I think, trying to achieve that target. And I think that's driven by a couple of things. The scale on this graph, I do want to point out, you know, maybe looks a little more dramatic than it is. The difference from where we were in 2005 to 2006 is really just a six percentage point decline. But I think one of the challenges that we're addressing here is as the population of the department continues to grow, finding that meaningful work responsibility to avoid inmate idleness becomes just an increasingly larger challenge. The department's also been very cautious about how much and who we allow on outside inmate work crews given security concerns, and our tightening of those issues has also, I think, had some effect on the measure. Finally, shortly after I came on as director, I requested our internal audits unit to review how we were actually tracking that to ensure that we were using the same sort of compliance measures in each of the individual institutions. As you might imagine, from the time a measure like this would come on and the requirement to report on it, over a number of years, the standards by which everyone is using to report full compliance with the measure changes over time. And so in reassessing that and having those audit findings from our internal audit office, I think also may have created some approach that was uniform in its treatment, but that caused a downturn in the actual number. One of the things I will say is what this measure measures is how many people are actually achieving the 40 hours of either programming or work, which means that if someone worked all but you got to 39 hours and not to the 40th hour, they're not included in this measure. So from a standpoint, it doesn't mean that there isn't anybody working or that there's this less a percentage not doing any work. It simply means that they didn't achieve a full 40-hour work week. And it was our stringentness in reporting that, I believe, after the audit, that may have had some impact on the decline of this measure. But I think it's consistent and reflects what it really is. And I think those factors have an impact on that performance measure. Moving on to performance, key performance measure number two.
Mr. Chair. Yes, just a minute. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Williams, so what you're saying is if an inmate averages 30 hours of work for the year, he or she is not included in this statistic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, the way this measure works is it requires compliance with ballot measure 17, which is the inmate has to be involved in work or programming for 40 hours a week. And it's my understanding that if you're below that 40 hours in a work week, you're not counted as compliant under measure 17. So that wouldn't be reflected in the pure calculation of this measure. It doesn't, I mean, for all other purposes, we're tracking that information and they're being engaged and the like. It just doesn't meet the standards for what the statutory requirement requires.
Just a follow-up, we might want to have a key performance measure that would show, regardless of Measure 17, if we have somebody who's working three-fourths time, this isn't showing us that we have that going on in our system, and I think that this could be very misleading to, you know, how much activity is really going on with inmates and how they're working. I just want to make that comment, and there might be some way to show that in the future, because 30 hours is better than zero, and this reflects zero.
Right. And Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I appreciate you saying that. That's one of the reasons I brought sort of the narrowness of the reporting on this measure forward to the committee.
And Max, part of that audit process was you going back and saying, okay, people have included this programming as work, and then you kind of reevaluated that, and that might have affected your numbers going down a little?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it did. I think what we wanted to ensure was that people were reporting the same thing the same way. So if there was a particular inmate at one institution who was putting in, you know, the number of hours in a given day, but was coming, you know, a little short, you know, that institution may have reported that inmate as being compliant when maybe they weren't fully compliant to the rule. Similar kinds of things might be happening with respect to the number of hours someone was involved in programming. So what we tried to do was just ensure through the audit process that it was being reported in a standardized way throughout the system and in accordance that we could reflect what the measure was that we'd been given.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron expressed my concerns, and what I would have looked for example, in a report would be what percentage were working 5 hours a week, and what percentage were working 10 and 15 and so on. And I imagine we would have seen something different. But then it also begs the issue of, well, what constitutes work? And is work the same as being trained? So we'd also benefit from understanding what qualifies.
On key performance measure 2, this measure is a reflection of corrections plan completion. This is one of the measures as well that we would be interested in potentially sort of refocusing some of our recommendations to the committee on how we measure. You can see that, again, the measure took some decline between 2005 to 2006. My understanding, and again, we'll discuss this in more detail during the transitional services portion of the presentation, this had to some degree to with our elimination of certain programming that we had determined wasn't, in fact, effective. And so as the effectiveness of the non-effective program was eliminated, fewer inmates were, the targeted inmates were getting programs that they were needing to complete and work on. Some inmates were getting less of those programs because the programs they were participating in weren't effective, and that had an effect on the decline in the percentage. And again, I know that Ginger Martin, our Assistant Director of Transitional Services, is prepared to talk a little bit more about this measure in her presentation.
If I can just add,
yes,
you know, that might actually be a case where a decline is a positive thing because we're taking a look at what's effective and what's not, and not just clinging to the way we've always done things.
Mr. Chair, and I would say that the percentage of inmates completing a corrections plan isn't necessarily, if what's in the plan isn't effective, isn't necessarily a good measure of anything. It's a measure of activity and not a measure of kind of performance or output. And we would want to, that's one of the ones we would want to talk about, likely recrafting in a way that would be more reflective of what we're doing and more informational to the committee.
And likewise, going back to the Measure 17 compliance, I would think that hours in treatment do not necessarily equate with effectiveness of treatment. So there are certain programs that if you do them twice, two or three times a week compared to for 8 hours a day, you might get the same amount of effectiveness, but that would affect your compliance rate, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, that's true. Performance measure 3 is a percentage of offenders on post-prison supervision convicted of a felony within 3 years of release. This is essentially the department's recidivism measure. The target for recidivism is not was not established, at least initially, either by the legislature or the department, but was established by the Oregon Progress Board as part of the Oregon Shines Project, which targeted that number at 28.8%. And the 2006 numbers, as you can see, I think for the first time in the department's history since measuring this, achieved, I think it's a 28.6% recidivism rate. I would anticipate, as you can see those numbers fluctuating over time, I would anticipate this number continuing to fluctuate to some degree in and around those areas. And yet, I think as we see over time, the whole idea of this number is really a trending number for us to watch over time. And I'm, you know, remain hopeful that the trend is going to continue to be in the direction reflective of these numbers. I'd also just remind the committee that this is a lagging indicator because it's really looking at cohorts of individuals who were released 3 years ago. At each point that it you apply the statistic, it's reflective of the kinds of interventions that may have been going on in the prison system 3 years ago, and as a result, again, I think is a fairly good, you know, over time trending indicator of direction.
Ms. Williams, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, and maybe I should know this and don't, but when would the first Measure 11 folks be coming out of Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, I believe that if Measure 11 was passed in 1994, and there may be somebody behind me who knows this number without me having to do the math in my head, but the sentences started being imposed sometime in 1995, and the minimum Measure 11 sentence was a 70-month sentence. So we've had probably 3 or 4 years now of sort of the initial lowest level Measure 11 offenders starting to return out to the community.
It just made me wonder, as we've seen the aging of the population in DOC, I mean, because of Measure 11, I mean, they're there longer, so they're older when they get out. With that, I mean, are you going to be watching that number to see if that modifies recidivism rate because you have older inmate getting out versus a younger? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, there are a number of interactions between the ages of inmates, the kind of crimes they commit, and their recidivism rates in sort of those narrow categories. And it's a rather complicated analysis. But we do watch for those kind of correlating factors. And to the extent you're interested, we could give you some data on how those interact. Certain kinds of crimes, inmates and offenders don't appear to age out of very effectively. Others, they do, and age does play a difference to some degree in recidivism, and it just really, to a great degree, varies by crime type.
One brief follow-up. Will we have any more data on that as we go through the presentation, as we talk about recidivism?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, I don't know that perhaps as we go through the transition and reentry conversations in Ms. Martin's presentation, there'll be some more. I don't know that we were planning on a lot of the research data being presented during the budget presentation, but if the committee's interested, we can pull perhaps a short kind of quick review of that together and just provide that to you individually, and then if you have more questions, we'd be happy to discuss them.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful if Mr. Bilotti has that type of data where he could take the recidivism rate of Measure 11 offenders and compare it to, say, Measure 11 eligible offenders, if that's easily available, or if not, we'll be in session till June.
Right. I mean, we can certainly try to work, and I think maybe the thing initially that would be informative to the committee is to give you some information about how recidivism is typically both a factor of crime type and age as at least factors that play a part in that interaction, and I think that data we do have. Often with our research department, it takes them doing the work, and then I have to find someone to translate it for me so I can understand it. So we'll try to have the translator prepare the review for you.
Mr. Chair, I'm not asking for a whole bunch of extra work, so your prerogative. It's interesting to me, but I'm not asking the agency to.
Well, no, I think it's a critical issue that we need to understand is whether or not locking up people longer, does that make it more or less likely that they'll recidivate is an important topic.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to Performance Measure 4, this is a Class 1 assaults on staff per 1,000 inmates. And we're pleased to see that even despite increases in population, we've been able to see that number actually trending down. And again, this is inmate assaults on staff. So these are the situations where our staff members are actually being assaulted. Any assault we take very seriously, and it's a significant issue to us. Just so you have a sense, the axis on the left there doesn't necessarily tell you, but the number I'm told as I ask the question is that's 81 in actual numbers on that 2006 number. So that's the number of staff members that were assaulted. And these are typically deemed to be serious enough assaults that a staff member was at least sought some level of medical attention and was monitored in that respect. So it can also include the kinds of assaults where staff have been hit with some sort of body fluid or similar kinds of issues inside the institution. So they're fairly significant, and we continue to do everything we can to try to find ways to protect our staff.
We've got some questions from the Senate side that must have just woken up. Senator Westland.
Oh, wait, yeah, senatorial naps. thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, at one time, I know Oregon was the or a national leader in the assault. I mean, in a good way, we had a very low percentage of assaults on staff. Are we still in that category, doing pretty well? I mean, how does this rank nationally is what I'm asking.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, I believe that we still, by sort of comparison, and when I say that, I mean broadly based on sort of almost more the anecdotal information I get in talking to folks in other systems, we're still a safe system by comparison to a lot of other places around the country. And as you can see the trending as it goes, you can see the total number of these kinds of assaults has actually declined. I think the challenge we have inside the institution is occasionally some of these are very, very challenging assaults. They're vicious. The damage is pretty significant, and as a result, it doesn't necessarily measure the intensity of the assault or the story behind each of these correctional officers or staff members of the department who were assaulted. I think we continue, against the growth in our population, continue to be a safe system, and that owes to the great credit of the tremendous 4,000 or so staff in the Department of Corrections who I think strive very hard to be first and foremost always paying attention to security, and secondly, I think our own ability to interact with offenders and the kind of populations that we operate has a lot to do with, I think, why we keep the institutions as safe as we are. There are factors like gang activity and similar kinds of factors like that that continue to keep us concerned and we think drive much of the kind of activity that you see here. And I'd also comment on the impact on the mental health side. I mean, you've seen the numbers I shared with the committee in the materials that I gave you today with the large growth of the mental health population that we have inside. They are a much more challenging population to supervise, no less dangerous as a result of their mental health diagnosis in many respects. But staff have continued to do a tremendous job in trying to manage those situations in a way that's kept this assault number heading in the right direction. So,
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Just a follow-up to Senator Wesley's question. I guess, you know, I have two prisons in my district. There's 3,200 beds, and so we have at least I get a lot of calls and complaints about staff assaults. And you know, that's my voting constituency out there when you've got that many prisoners. And we've talked about this, I know, and I just want to put it on the record to indicate that there is a concern there that even though these measurements are low, you know, when that one person, maybe because of lack of communication or something that goes on between the management and he doesn't know that the type of prisoners that are coming in, that we could make a lot make it a lot safer, at least in the view of some of my folks out there. They're very concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your interest in this issue. It is something that we take very, very seriously. Anytime a staff member in the Department of Corrections is injured in any way, but particularly in contact with an inmate, we do a very thorough review of what occurred in the situation to determine if there's a lessons learned or if there's a ball that's been dropped. I will say that as the system has grown larger over time, there were times, and I've talked to old-timers in the department, there were times when everybody knew who the major players in an institution or even in the whole system were. So when an inmate got transferred from one facility to another, even the people at OSCI knew if this guy was coming over from the penitentiary, they knew about him, and they knew who he was, and they knew what he was in for, and they knew what his behavior had been. As the system has grown so much over time, that individual knowledge of individual inmates has just become more complex. The number of employees has grown, the number of inmates has grown, and so we have used technology and are developing technology to help us address those issues, and we've recently developed an alert system that actually tracks key indicators that's going to, I believe, provide institutions a better way to know when they've got somebody walking in the door as they're being transferred from one facility to another, who it is and what needs to be addressed and how they need to manage this individual. And that process is developed out of our continuing efforts to try to strive for a greater degree of knowledge and security within the institution to address the very issues that your constituents have raised with you. So it isn't something that we're at all ignoring, and even seeing these numbers decline, 81 individuals is 81 people in the department, and the number ought to be zero in our world if you could do that. And it's a challenging job with challenging individuals.
Just a follow-up. Do you think there's a way you can identify a percentage of the whole prison population, whether there's 13,000 in prison, to say there's 1% of those are troublemakers, or 2%, or 10%? Is there any way to quantify that? Or can you identify those, or can you even profile them?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, this alert system that is currently in development right now does some of that, uses a variety of factors, whether they've had certain kinds of misconducts or whether they've previously assaulted staff, and then creates essentially a way to identify whether or not they are or aren't somebody that ought to be being watched. And that works to a degree. I mean, it's better than no information at all. But someone who's never assaulted staff and tomorrow assaults staff, well, if they've never assaulted a staff member before and otherwise had good conduct, they might have not been on the system. So you can do a lot with the data that you have, and then you have to acknowledge that there are going to be limitations, and there are going to be people that do things that no matter how much information you had on them, you couldn't have predicted their behavior. And therein lies the challenge. And one of the things that we talk about is not getting too focused and too reliant on those kinds of things to drive your knowledge. There's a lot of just inherent knowledge that these correctional officers are aware of, based on just how somebody's performing or somebody's change in behavior from when they saw them yesterday, that informs them in a lot of ways probably better than technology does. And so it's a lot of those security fundamentals that we continue to talk about institutionally as well.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Williams. Safety obviously is important for you and for your staff and for us here. And I, like we were talking on measure, on key performance measure one, I think that maybe if we had some ways to look at this besides just the numbers, if we had some lost time numbers, in other words, 81 assaults led to, however many days of lost time on staff's part compared to, in 2003, we might have had more assaults, but they might have been minor assaults, and just the degree of those things, I think would be very beneficial for us to say we are, in fact, becoming safer, or we are, in fact, even though we have maybe 60 next year, but they were real dangerous assaults or whatever.
Right.
I think that would be helpful for the committee in the future.
And that may be then one of the things, Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I appreciate that, as we move towards the work session conversation about any changes to the performance measures, we'll toy with some of those things and maybe come forward with some recommendations to the committee about other ways to reflect this data.
Thank you.
Max, if I could also ask a follow-up question. The difference between 0.45 and, say, 0.82 or 4 in the assaults on staff, Do you have any sense, is that, I mean, could that just be left to chance, or is there statistical significance in those differences? Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't, actually. I'm not sure that I, you know, with the level of the data that we've got here, I'm not sure that we could draw sort of statistical significance associated with those.
Okay.
And as the question was posed initially about, you know, are we safe as compared to other kinds of systems, we fall back into that same kind of problem where not all systems measure their assaults the same sort of way. It's a little bit like comparing crime types around the country. You know, what's a misdemeanor in one state might be a C felony in another state. And the same is true for how prison systems around the country measure their assaultive behavior. What might be a minor assault in one system, you know, we might call a class one assault in our system. So it is very difficult to get that kind of comparative data at that level to know. Our sense is that we continue to run, by comparison, pretty safe systems generally.
Do we know if, and maybe Colette, you might know this too, has BJS ever tried to make that kind of comparison? I've never seen it, but...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not familiar with them doing that. I know that ASCA, which is the Association of State Correctional Administrators, of which I'm a member, is working on a long-term 10-year project to try to move to a standardized reporting measure for performance measure purposes, and that's an ongoing project over time, to essentially trying to get all the states to count the same things in the same baskets that would allow for that kind of comparator.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Members of the committee, performance measure 5 is the rate of inmate walkaways from minimum custody facilities. These are outside work crews, so these are the individuals who are going out and working in the community. And as you can see, back at around the beginning of the decade, 1999-2000, the rate was fairly high. That rate was adjusted downward in 2001, and we continue to perform at below the target, which we're very happy about. We have seen a bit of an increase over the last couple of years, again, we're not sure that that's necessarily driven by anything we can identify specifically. Again, to give you a number so that 2006 number makes sense to you, that's actually 7 walkaways over the course of that year, individuals who walked off of a work crew. These are all minimum custody inmates who have been cleared to do outside work crew. And while we're not happy that that number has increased, I guess the good news is that all 7 of them were ultimately returned to custody, and they, given now their bad choice, will never be assigned to an outside work crew for the remainder of their sentence. And in some cases, I believe some of them were charged with felony escape and will actually add time to their sentence, which is an unfortunate outcome of a very poor choice.
Did any of those 7 end up doing any significant crime while they were on their spree?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm trying to recall them individually. I don't believe that any of them were involved in any additional major crime during their time on the lam. I may be, if I'm wrong about that, I'm happy to come back and correct it, but nothing stands out. Usually the recovery is relatively soon after they've walked away. Occasionally it goes on for a little longer than that.
And generally these are, I assume you put the inmates through some kind of risk assessment so that you feel like they're a pretty good bet if they do walk away?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there is a battery of risk assessment that they go through to qualify to be included in outside work crew, along with some very strict limitations by our own policies about the kinds of offenders that we will allow to even be considered. So those things working together have an approach that tries to limit this. And we really think that it has been that approach that's allowed for the decline dating back from the 99 period to really get tighter about who we allow out on these kinds of crews. More often than not, my experience has suggested that typically when somebody walks off a work crew like this, because, you know, usually they're within, you know, sometimes just a year of release, sometimes even shorter than that, occasionally a little bit longer, but usually it's been they've gotten a letter from home about a girlfriend or something like that that's kind of driven them to make poor choices. It's usually something that's going on the outside that drives their decision. Looking at key performance measure 6, This is a measure, again, that we want to probably have a conversation about, and it actually ties off a little bit with a comment that Representative Cameron made. But currently, this measure measures workers' compensation time loss claims per 100 employees. And you can see a fairly substantial jump and above our target, even though we had adjusted the target with the legislature's approval in the last legislative session for the 2006 time frame. And that reflects the number of injuries in the system where there was actually a time loss claim. Most of these are not related, as I pointed out. A small percentage of our total injuries department-wide are related to actual inmate interactions. The vast majority, in the 80% plus, are your traditional trips, slips, falls, strains, the kinds of workplace injuries that happen anywhere. I think the challenge in our organization is, as we've talked about, we are operating in lots of different places and lots of different communities, 24/7 in a lot of different kinds of institutions with a lot of people doing a lot of physical work. And we're trying to understand this issue better. The department's actively involved right now in the statewide safety management. I sit on that statewide board, and we're spending a lot of time and effort right now trying to develop a better understanding about what's going on internally in the safety culture within the department, and that's going to be an ongoing process and one of the strategic initiatives for the next biennium in the department. If there was any good news associated that you don't see reflected in this particular performance measure, but you will see, as our Human Resources Assistant Director does her presentation, the number of those time loss claims went from 74 to 108 between 2005 and 2006. But the total value, dollar value, of those time loss claims for that period only increased by $63,000. So it's a classic example of the point, I think, that Representative Cameron was making. The total number of claims increased substantially, but the actual impact of those claims, the actual value of the time loss, wasn't a substantial increase. The dollar values actually stayed relatively constant for the impact. And we think that has a lot to do with our approach about getting individuals who have suffered a minor injury back to work in some other kind of position or responsibility in the department to limit the impact and the length that they're out on that time loss claim. And we've been pretty aggressive about trying to manage those claims once they've occurred. Now we're moving to the role of where we're going to be getting more aggressive about why they occurred in the first place and trying to improve that safety culture within the department.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Mr. Williams, the $63,000, or that's the increase, where does that show up in your operating results, the workers' comp time loss?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, it doesn't show up in my presentation, but there is a chart reflecting that in the HR. So when our Human Resources Director presents later in the week, or early next week, depending on how the schedule goes, there is data in her presentation around this performance measure that will show you that other breakdown based on the total value of those dollar value associated with those time loss claims. And I wouldn't be able to give you the page number now, but the chart does exist in your binder.
Okay, just for, if I may, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, so the actual charges do come back to the department, though?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we get a Representative Cameron, we get a report, I want to say quarterly, that reflects what our impact in those charges were, and whether those charges come directly back to the department or whether it goes into my overall DAS risk assessment number that I have to pay biennially, that's sort of my statewide insurance policy for these kinds of claims. One way or another, those charges ultimately come back to my budget.
Thank you.
Page 20 under Human Resources.
So in the Human Resources tab, it's page 20. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Moving on to Performance Measure 7, this is a performance measure that was originally designed and was measured on kilowatt hours. In the last legislative session, we were able to shift the measurement from a kilowatt hour message to a BTU per square foot measure, which we thought was a better indication of energy usage, in part because so much of our energy now is natural gas that's actually causing, you know, the heating and the like inside our system. So you can see the target reflected there. My understanding is if we use the BTU per square foot measure and review that over time, we've had about a 16% reduction since 2000. In our BTU per square foot usage. And the department continues to try to find ways to focus on what we can do to lower our overall energy costs. Our energy costs increased, obviously, over the last biennium simply due to the price issues related to energy everywhere. But our actual usage continues to be on the decline, and that's one of the ways we continue to try to manage this issue for us internally. On performance measure 8, this measure is measuring the number of level 1 misconducts, and this is different than assaults. This is misconducts which could be, and including assaults, but could also include weapons charges, major contraband charges, and similar sorts of issues. And that's reflecting the difference between the 2005-2006 time frame. And this is, again, one of the ways we try to measure what's going on, particularly in the offender population inside. One of the things this measure isn't telling us, and it's, again, one of the issues that we're trying to drill down on ourselves, is how many, and I think it was the point that Senator Nelson made, how many of the individuals that are triggering these level one misconducts are coming from the very same people. So if you have a handful of bad actors who are consistently getting themselves into trouble, they can drive that measure fairly substantially. Similarly, large group disturbances, so any kind of a major group disturbance at an institution could trigger an increase in these level one misconducts. And so we're continuing to drill down to try to understand what the increase is being driven by here in 2006. But it's obviously an issue that we are concerned about because those level one misconducts reflect inmate behavior.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indeed, that would be something to be very concerned about. In addition to you're trying to seek more information, is this how many of these are the same person versus different persons? Is it possible that any of these there could be more than one statistic based on the same incident? Like if there was an assault that included a weapon, or someone was discovered with contraband and there was also a weapon, does that count as two things or one incident?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, that's a question that I pose myself, and I'm not sure I know the answer. I think it's quite likely that it could count as two. And so there may be incidents of the same individual being involved in multiple issues that would result in reflections of multiple major misconducts. And I think that's one of the things that isn't well sorted out in the way that the data is gathered for this particular performance measure.
Senator Wesson.
So just in keeping round numbers, if I do my math right, this is a 125 or so incidents.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westland, my sort of back of the envelope calculation suggests that this averages about 120 per month throughout the system. So,
quarter.
Well, it's measured per quarter. It's a per quarter measurement on the measure, but as I broke it down and tried to get to a monthly number, I think, at least my numbers are suggesting, I think it's about 120 a month, which, you know, again, for a system that's got 13,500 people in it. Would like the number to obviously be lower, but I'm not sure, again, as we drill down on this, that it necessarily suggests that there's any kind of a crisis. I think it's just getting a better idea of who we're counting and are we counting them twice and how are we reflecting it. We have had over time some increase in the number of group disturbance issues that are just, I think, a function of the system, again, continuing to get larger. The other thing I'd also mention is that this is also a bit like almost every other statistic. To the extent that you start pushing enforcement on particular issues, so if you've got an issue, for example, involving weapons, and you've had an incident at an institution where a couple of weapons have either been discovered or found, and you decide to do a full-down shakedown of that institution for a security purpose, you go in and you put a lot of pressure and enforcement on and go through that process, you're going to potentially find more incidents. It's not, again, not necessarily a bad thing. It's a function of actually doing what you ought to be doing, but it would have the impact potentially of having more people charged with a level one misconduct. So I'm not even completely convinced that all this is necessarily bad. It may be we're being more attentive to the things that would trigger a finding of a level one misconduct in the process. So all those things are kind of at play, I think, in this particular performance measure.
Mr. Chair, if I could, maybe another way to present this at round numbers, 120 a month, that means that, these cherubic Boy Scouts that you have in your care custody, that's about 1%, a little bit less than 1% a month are doing something that creates a reportable incident.
Yeah. I think that's an accurate reflection, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland. Key performance measure 9. I'm pleased to report that the department has hit its target on this measure. This is one we take very seriously, obviously. This is the number of escapes per year from secure custody where we have an armed perimeter. And I'm pleased to report, knocking on every possible wood that I can find, that currently in 2006, as it was before, that's zero for this last reportable period. In performance measure 10,
Max, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Westland.
I mean, you've been doing so well, we're used to seeing you exceeding your performance measures, and you obviously have not exceeded this performance measure.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm not exactly sure how we do that, but if you count against our population increase, I guess that would count as we have more at the end of the year than we started out with. I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing either, but it is measurable.
You've got to exceed these performance
numbers.
Senator Westland, we're taking a tour tomorrow. You might be the negative one that gets
gets locked in the broom closet and has exceeded it.
Moving on to performance measure 10, this is, again, a new measure that was added, but this is the number of escapes per year from DOC minimum custody facilities. Again, these minimum custody facilities in some cases are fenced and in other cases are unfenced minimums around the state where, again, they're fairly we spent a lot of time figuring out who to put in these facilities. But that number, just so you again have a sense of how many those were, that was actually 2 in 2006. And that's been, and both were recaptured. And we're currently conducting a review right now about processes and procedures at our minimum facilities just to ensure that we're doing everything that we need to. But I'll give you an example. At Mill Creek, which is the facility out here in Salem that's near the old farm annex building, there's over 300 inmates that are minimum custody inmates that are housed at that facility, and that facility doesn't have a fence. We rarely have a problem there, and these are inmates, by and large, all of whom are out doing work crew work in the community at parks and other places on the sides of the roads that you see sometimes when you're driving around here in Salem. But occasionally somebody does, in fact, walk away from one of these facilities, and that reflects here in this performance measure.
2007, you've had no escape so far?
No, we have, actually. This data wasn't reflecting the total of 2007 data, since 2007 isn't over, but we have had a fairly notorious one that occurred in 2007 from our southern facility, Shutter Creek Correctional Facility in North Bend, a minimum custody inmate who actually tied up a nurse, was in the infirmary on a sick call. Tied the nurse up, didn't do her any other physical harm besides the tying her up, as I understand it, but then stole her keys and her vehicle and then crashed through the fence and was on the run for about a week and a half and was actually recaptured here in Salem. And that's that event is also part of this review that we're doing for policies at these minimum facilities. The reality is, with all the risk assessment and all of the efforts, you can plan for just about anything, and we attempt to do a lessons learned on every one of these events, and yet you still find situations where it's going to be an unpredictable result. If there were things that we should have done differently at that facility, or if this individual made it through and shouldn't have, then those are things we'll learn from when the review's complete.
Max, did that person, when they were on the lam, commit any crimes? Besides absconding?
No, they committed plenty on their way out. I don't recall that they were involved in any other major criminal activity. They may have had a breaking and entering charge in a home here in Salem. I'm not exactly sure how that ended up. It was the Salem Police Department that ultimately recovered the individual who was hid out in an attic area in a house, and they actually put the dog up in the attic because they couldn't get up there and they didn't know what they had, and the dog was apparently rather effective in bringing a resolution to the event. So, but I don't recall that there was any other major crime committed.
Excuse me, do you know what he was in originally for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I don't recall.
I would assume it would be, since he's minimum security, it might not have been one of the worst kind of people you have anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, a couple of these over the last couple of years have merged together in my mind enough that I don't want to get myself trapped by telling you something that might be wrong, but we could certainly give you some detail on his history if you're interested. Yeah.
If you could share it with professional staff.
Sure. Absolutely. Performance measure 11, percentage of inmates who successfully complete transitional leave. This is a measure, again, that is primarily focused on trying to help gauge for us our effectiveness with respect on individuals who return to the community on a transitional leave program. The 2006 data that we have shows us exceeding that measure, and we're obviously pleased with that. That's typically a 90-day period where people who participated in that program that allows transitional leave can, if they complete the 90 days, essentially end their prison term at that point and move on to post-prison supervision. So we're relatively pleased with the results from that, of people demonstrating that at least during that 90-day period they can keep themselves effectively on their transition plan and not commit a new offense or violate the terms of their transitional leave that requires them coming back into prison.
Senator Brown.
Thank you. Is there, Max, is there a huge differential in the transitional leave and age categories, do you know? I mean, I would guess that 30-year-olds are less likely to complete it successfully than 65-year-olds. Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, we talked a little bit about that earlier in the presentation, about the differences between issues of recidivism, for example, and the age correlation and the crime type correlation. I don't specifically recall looking at data that identified by age category those who successfully complete and don't complete transitional leave. My guess would be that you're probably not mistaken, that we see a higher failure rate among younger offenders on transitional leave than we do on older offenders who complete transitional leave. But I'm sort of guessing based on other data I've looked at over time that would lead me to conclude that. But I don't know that I've seen specific data where we've targeted that age category representation. It's probably data we could do. I just don't know that I've seen it.
Yeah.
Senator Nelson.
Just a question to follow up on that is, there's about a 12% increase. Is there any specific reasons why you can see the 12% increase or the this is an improvement, I take it, if I read this right.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Nelson, it is an improvement. And I'm not exactly sure that we could tie it to anything other than an increased focus both internally in the department and externally with our community partners on doing effective transition. I mean, these are a particular category of offenders who participate in transitional leave, and as a result, they're targeted perhaps a little bit more carefully as they come back into the community, both by the community corrections folks who have supervision responsibilities for them when they get back, but also because they remain under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections, their institutional counselors are also following their activity and communicating with those community folks. And that in and of itself probably creates an environment that is a better environment for getting these people services that helps them succeed on transition. I don't know that beyond sort of those really general rationales I could give you anything more specific, and I don't want to be accused of drawing conclusions when I don't have data to necessarily support them.
Thank you.
It's called speculation. We allow it.
All right. So long as it's allowed and I'm not punished for it later if I'm proven wrong.
Any other questions? Colleagues, I just want to kind of clarify what we're talking about here. A large number of these people who get transitional leave are in the alternative incarceration program. Is that correct, Mr.
Chair? Yes, Mr. Chair.
And could you describe some of the what it takes to be deemed worthy of the alternative incarceration program, just so that we all know about that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the alternative incarceration program really originally started a number of years ago as the department opened up the Shutter Creek facility down in North Bend. Was expanded to some degree in 2003 as we enhanced the alcohol and drug treatment capacity at the Powder River facility in Baker City. And then it also operates with a small unit at the women's facility in Coffee Creek. So female offenders also have access to the program. And there's a long list of statutory restrictions because it does allow for a reduction in the amount of the sentence that a person serves. No Measure 11 offenders, for example, can participate in the program serving a Measure 11 sentence because you can't reduce the Measure 11 sentence. Other kinds of serious person crimes are by and large excluded from who can participate. So as a result, you typically have individuals who have created lower level person crimes or perhaps some property crimes who are then eligible for the program. Once in the program, they have to essentially perform in either program at a performance level that right now has somewhere in the neighborhood of about a 50% dropout rate. In other words, they can't complete the program because they're of their own inability to comply with the rigor associated with the program. But the idea is that they can complete the intensive A&D treatment program, for example, at Powder River, and then they're allowed to go out on a 90-day transitional leave where they're supervised like they would be in the community once they had completed prison. If they're successful in completing that 90-day supervision and they've completed the program, then they're allowed a reduction in their overall sentence and they finish out the remainder of their time on post-prison supervision. If they fail at any point during the program or at any point during the 90 days on transitional leave, they're pulled back into the Department of Corrections, into prison, and they complete the remainder of their sentence as it was described by the court.
Can I ask you a question about that? How does that differ between if somebody's on community corrections post prison supervision and transitional leave?
Once someone is under post-prison supervision, so they've been released from the Department of Corrections and they've completed their prison sentence, but they're now under their post-prison supervision, typically the department doesn't have the ability, even for a violation of their post-prison supervision, to pull them all the way back in on a revocation into prison. They might be sanctioned locally and serve time either in a local jail or through some other community sanction imposed by the supervisory authority, which is typically the community corrections office in that community.
So they can get snatched right back into the state prison system.
The transitional leave individuals, if they fail during that 90-day period of transitional leave, will come right back into the Department of Corrections and complete the remainder of their sentence.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned there was maybe about a 50% success rate in this. I think you said something about 50%, mm-hmm. And I'll phrase my question, and you can correct me
okay.
if that was wrong. You also had referred to alcohol and drug treatment programs in mm-hmm. some facilities. Whenever there is alcohol and drug treatment, since we also know that some very large percentage, whether it's 50 or 55%, I forget, of persons with alcohol and drug-related problems also have mental health problems. When you provide alcohol and drug treatment services, do you also provide the mental health treatment that would have been necessary for that 55% or so?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, so I'll clarify first my 50% comment. As we've been reviewing the statistical information around the alternative incarceration program, one of the things we figured out is that there is about a 50% failure rate of people who can't complete. It's a fairly small number who get in generally throughout the system, and then there's about a 50% failure rate, either inside the institution or when they get on the transitional leave, they just can't maintain the rigor, they can't be compliant, and so they don't either complete the program inside or they're pulled back in while on transitional leave. With respect to your question regarding alcohol and drug treatment, the department does operate some degree of co-occurring disorder treatment programs, programs that are specifically recognizing the tie-in between the mental health issue and the addiction issue for the population that are evaluated at the time they come into intake to have those kinds of problems. They're obviously targeted and prioritized through our system to try to get access to those services. I would suggest to you that, and you'll see that we've got some of that built into the effort that we're trying to address with the construction of the Deer Ridge facility and the staffing of that facility, and then also in our policy option packages. We're continuing to have more people with a need than we have the availability of slots. But we do run co-occurring disorder programs inside the system. And for those individuals who have both an addiction and a mental health issue, we attempt to match those services to those individuals to get them into the right program.
And that will be part of your policy option package as well?
Mr. Chair, it will be part of discussions around both kind of our plans for the Deer Ridge facility and the enhancement of available treatment beds in the department at that facility, and conversations relative to just the general delivery of alcohol and drug treatment services as part of our policy option packages.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so 50% dropout and then 85% of the ones remaining, I presume, successfully complete their transitional leave. That's 85% of the 50%.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yeah, that would be that would be the way you would do that, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what is the fiscal impact of all this when you have basically, and I'm a terrible mathematician, but 85% of 50% successfully completing their transitional leave, i.e., they get shorter sentences because of successfully completing the program. What is the fiscal impact of this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's not a number that I have right on the top of my head. I think the thing to remember is there's a fairly narrow group of people who are participating in the program in the first place. So it's not a program that a large percentage of the department offenders under our supervision get to participate in initially. So as that number narrows down to the small subset who actually do participate in the program, and then you have the 50% and then the 85% kind of cull out, that gets you down to that smaller number. Obviously, because there is a sentence reduction that averages somewhere in the neighborhood of about a year, averaging out sort of the high and the low ends among participants in AIP, that does make an impact. You know, our average cost right now is somewhere probably between $25,000 to $27,000 per year per inmate. So if that's the average sentence reduction for everybody who does it, it averages out to about that degree of savings. I can get more specific data for you about the fiscal impacts associated with that, if you'd care to see it. And I know we've been working on that in view of the other conversations we're currently having more up in the policy committees generally, and we'll be having regarding the whole AIP issue and some recommended changes that we anticipate the department will be coming forward with. And all that will have to be worked out with fiscal. Everything we have currently is sort of back of the envelope calculations until we get a final version of a bill where then the Criminal Justice Commission has to actually do the analysis of what the fiscal would actually be.
Here to follow up, because I'm sure you spend some upfront money in these programs, you know, for the drug treatment itself, because not everybody in prison gets the drug treatment. So I'd be very interested in finding out the net savings. And also, this really talks about successfully completing transitional leave. It doesn't address recidivism.
That's correct.
So it'd be very interesting if you have any data on recidivism too, compared to other programs.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, this was again a measure that we were toying with some better ways to reflect what would be meaningful here, and this definitely gives you sort of who successfully completed transitional leave. It doesn't give you much in the nature of a qualitative measure, and so some of the stuff that you're going to be reviewing as Ms. Martin presents regarding the Transitional Services Division,
number of offenders who we're releasing currently who at the time of release have housing or access to treatment or employment, we think are probably in the long run more qualitative measures about whether or not these individuals are ultimately going to be proving successful. And that's not waiting necessarily to have to go clear to the 3 years out to then track the recidivism data, which obviously is a lagging indicator, you know, for each of those cohorts having to wait 3 years to kind of see what the final recidivism numbers are. But some of those other measures about what we would anticipate based on the research would suggest people are going to be successful qualitatively may be a better way to actually look at those populations that we're releasing and not just focus it solely on this group of people that are going out on transitional leave, but look more broadly at transitional indicators for the entire population, not just the group of people who participated in the AIP program. So that would be a direction that the committee would like to go and entertain those conversations with you again as we move to a discussion of the specific measures during work session. The final key performance measure for the department is the one that satisfied the requirement that was imposed on all agencies to create a customer satisfaction performance measure. The department focused on, because of our focus on transition and reentry, to try to get an understanding of our interrelationship with parole officers, post-prison supervision folks. And so the department did a survey. It targeted actually specific, not just sort of a survey of everybody, but we actually looked at data dealing with recent people who had worked and have been released out for transition purposes, so we could measure recent experiences and not just, you know, one, you know, someone who maybe hadn't dealt with the department in the last 5 years. They did about 665 surveys to random parole officers around the state. There was about an 82% response rate from individuals responding to those surveys. And this gives you at least some sense of their responses. Generally, somewhere between, I think, 82 and 86% on those categories. We were encouraged by that, believing that they are a key for us in successfully moving offenders back into the community with the right kind of information and access to the right kind of programming. And this is something we're going to continue to enhance and monitor as a baseline for some period of time as we try to, you know, continue to develop our relations with our community corrections customers. So any questions about that measure?
What's the standard? Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wesson.
Your numbers.
This was a baseline survey, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland. This was this new requirement that you have some sort of a customer service performance measure built into your performance measures. As it came out, there was a lot of discussion internally about who are DOC's customers. And how would you pick the right set of measures? Because of our focus on transition and reentry and our need to really work with our community corrections partners and effectively transitioning people back into the community, we thought the parole officers who most often, you know, sort of have to deal with the offenders as they're releasing and our people to know what they need to know was a good place to start. But there was no prior baseline established for the measure, and this gave us at least the opportunity to figure out what a baseline set of responses were that we could then monitor over some period of time to determine whether we're improving our effectiveness in working with this particular group of people that we're serving or whether it's going the wrong direction.
Mr. Williams, I assume on these you're also counting release plans that are, say, 90% completed or 95%. I can't imagine every part of everybody's release plan is fully figured out 60 days before they go, but you're getting it to the parole board, and they're helping fill in the blanks, I presume.
Yeah, and I've made a mistake here, and I apologize, Mr. I've turned the page, and I skipped 12 and started talking about 13, and so I was on 13, and you were referencing 12, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for that.
Nobody knew.
Well, I was hoping everybody else was looking at 13 with me as we were going down those key performance measures on our parole officer. On the measure 12, percentage of release plans submitted by the department, again, you've got exactly the point that I've made in my own notes here. There's no question now that we're well exceeding our target of getting those plans to them in a timely basis. The question is, what's the quality of the plan? And again, it's that issue that we want to look at and figure out if there's a way now to measure. Yeah, you got 92 or 94% of the plans are getting to the board on time. is the quality of the plan sufficient? Is it got everything in it that it needs to have in it? And that's going to be something that, again, we're going to want to discuss with the committee.
That was a check and balance in the system that I wasn't quite familiar with until I heard the board of our Pearls mm-hmm. talk about that. If you know, if you did have a couple of things that maybe the address actually exists, that they would hopefully catch that and make sure Community Corrections knew about it. And that
right.
seemed like a good check and balance.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, that I skipped 12 and went right to 13, but now you see the numbers on where we were on 13. Mr. Chairman, just to go quickly then on to the next item, if there aren't questions, the next item in the presentation is the DOC priority list. This list is, again, one of the things that was mandated in the budget presentation, and you'll see the agency priority ranking on the left, and then each program division ranked their, you know, each component, and you'll see that division on the right. There will be a separate list per division that gives you the divisional program rankings as you go through here. I guess the one thing I'd mention about DOC's priority list is much of what we do is mandated, either constitutionally mandated in the kind of care and supervision that we have to give the offenders, or statutorily mandated with respect to issues involving education and the like. So you have to move quite a ways down our priority list. And to some of these, it's hard to know how would you rank one mandate versus another mandate when you really don't have much of an option about whether you're doing, you know, both of them. And so just bear that in mind. Some of these had to end up being a little bit arbitrary in our selection because we're really not allowed under the Constitution to not do either of them. And a classic example would be the difference between medical and mental health services. I mean, we have the same constitutional obligation to provide those services at a community-based standard for offenders and not to be deliberately indifferent to their care, regardless of whether it's medical or mental health. So how we rank those on this list was really, you know, kind of a Hobson's choice. It doesn't really mean very much, but we did give them a ranking as required. The next major unit here for conversation is the 10% reduction plan. And this is just, again, kind of an outline of the approach to the 10%. It's important, I think, here to just point out a couple of things. If you look at the DOC's budget, as we've kind of talked previously, the three major components of the Department of Corrections budget from those earlier slides, you'll recall, is the operations piece, what it takes to actually run the prisons themselves and, you know, the supervision and care and feeding and custody of those inmates. The next big chunk is the community corrections budget. That's the pass-through dollars that goes back out to the counties for that community supervision. And then the next biggest chunk is our debt service. So it doesn't give you a lot of room in either of those three categories to really do much to get to something like a 10%. So you'll see in this presentation a couple of things. One is about a $21 million reduction, which would be sort of like an across-the-board reduction vis-a-vis the community corrections piece. And then to really get to 10% in the department, you have to look at item number 15, which is the institutional closures. It would delay the startup and the opening of the Deer Ridge facility in Madras and to close four men's minimum custody facilities within all the related reductions in the central services and programs by being able to close those institutions. And if you did that, you could get to about $101 million out of the department's total operations. The challenge with that, obviously, are kind of listed over on the offside there about both the delays and closures, the incoming inmate population, and then the layoffs and the like that would result. If you chose to not release offenders but to crowd them into existing institutions but still close those institutions down, you have to recognize you wouldn't get much in that way of reduction because you'd still have to have the staffing cost to provide the supervision regardless of where you put those offenders. So you'd have to factor that back in. So it's just, again, an example of, I think, the limitations in a budget like ours to get to, you know, a 10% reduction. You got to cut pretty deep into that operations side because that's where so much of the resource currently in the department really is. So those are there for your review and perusal. I know we'll have a further opportunity to talk about them. And I just wanted to kind of touch base on those quickly. In the amount of time we've got left, and I know that we're probably, as I finish up, we're likely not going to get to Mr. Zerniak today, but you'll have your opportunity to spend some time with him on the tour tomorrow if you're planning on
on attending the tour. I thought I'd just take a minute and walk you through just briefly our long-range efficiency and quality improvements recommendations, and then just touch briefly on our policy option packages. On the long-range efficiency and quality improvements, long-range was sort of the approach we took, at least initially, on these that we have on this page 57. And it's really to continue our effort to focus research-based principles into correctional programming to try to gain that greater reduction in recidivism over time. We think this remains one of the great opportunities for the department. As you've seen the presentation by Mr. Oss and Mr. Prinz, the idea of a portfolio sort of approach to investment and program over time, both at our level and at the intervention level and at the prevention level, would allow us to continue to slow the long-term growth of prisons and construction in this system. And really, I think, is a great place where you can identify where savings over time could come from. Internally, what we try to do and what we're continuing to get better at doing is targeting treatment to high-risk offenders. So those who have the most likelihood of going out and committing a new crime upon release are the people who we're spending the time on trying to get them in a position where they're going to be less likely to do so and therefore not reenter the system. Deliver the evidence-based interventions to address criminal risk factors and design those programs for the target groups. And again, the example from data all around the country that suggests the kind of reduction you can have in recidivism when you're targeting individuals who have alcohol and drug addictions suggests that an investment in those kinds of programs can have a reduction in recidivism for those populations.
And colleagues, just to piggyback off of what Director Williams says, on March 12th, we're going to have the nation's preeminent expert on what works and what doesn't in corrections programming, a gentleman named Ed Latessa, who's informed the Department of Corrections analysis of this, as well as OYA. So when you see them saying that this percentage of our treatment is evidence-based, it's in part based on the work of Dr. Latessa, who will be with us. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just follow up there. You know, we had the testimony from Stephen, what's his name?
Aos.
Aos. And, you know, basically that is showing substantial, I mean, billions of dollars of decreases in the, if we can prevent or stop or not build more prisons so we keep these people out of prison. Is this committee going to attempt to do anything along that line? Is that one of the objects that we're trying to do? I mean, we're talking about efficiency and the quality and where our priorities are. It seems to me if we can look 10 years down the line that we're going to save $2 billion a year, and that's what we ought to be doing right now. I mean, are we just going to do the same old, and approve the budget and come back next session and have the same conversation?
And figure out whether or not we can shave off what percentage here, percentage there. I think your point is very well taken. That's why it's important for us to work with the policy committees to really determine where we can get the best bang for the buck in public safety. And, there are several bills that will be looking at that during this session, trying to figure out where that sweet spot is.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams, on reduce recidivism, one of the points is to target treatment to high-risk offenders. Is there any research or findings that you have to share with us about the timing of treatment? For example, if an offender is going to be in prison for X number of years, does the treatment occur early or late? Does it occur right before release or one of the alternative incarceration programs? And as far as value for dollar spent, is there any information about when the treatment is most effective for long-term benefit?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathanson, there's actually quite a bit of research in particularly with respect to addiction treatment, drug and alcohol treatment, that suggests that the treatment is most effective nearing the point when the individual is going to be releasing back to the community. And so we do attempt to use evidence-based approaches in trying to target at the timing of those interventions. So as this individual comes into the department and goes through the intake process in the department and is available evaluated and put through the various components of our review, their corrections plan is built based on that. And then the attempt is, given the given both their conduct and how they want to perform during their period of incarceration, the attempt is to try to target those interventions. Oftentimes, people need multiple interventions. So you may have somebody who isn't even reading at the eighth grade level, which is one of the standards that we're statutorily required to focus on while someone is in the system. So during the period of time they're in, they may be spent time both working on their adult basic education issues, and as they're nearing release, then they would move into a pool, essentially, where that, as a bed became available, that'd be assigned to drug and alcohol treatment right prior to their release back into the community. So there's a lot of data with respect to that and a lot of research that sort of informs us about when to target. And I want to make the point, and I sometimes skip over it, targeting treatment to high-risk offenders. The high risk we're talking about here is the high risk to recidivate. We're not talking about high risk in the nature of the kind of crime they committed. The high risk I'm focusing on here is the high risk to recidivate. Targeting those offenders, and oftentimes the offenders who are high risk to recidivate aren't the people that are out there necessarily committing the most grievous person crimes. They're often somebody who's got an addiction problem, and they're high risk to recidivate because they've been doing a lot of identity theft or a lot of theft-type crimes and are continuing to kind of re-enter the system over and over and over again. And those are the people that we're really trying to target, so when they get back out into the community, they're not going to go create a whole bunch of new victims and end up coming in and costing the system ultimately millions and millions and millions of dollars because we haven't gotten treatment to them soon enough or early enough. Was that answering your question?
Yeah. And if I could also add, isn't it true also that you have to kind of weigh in the institution whether or not somebody might need some type of programming early so that you can affect the assaults and their behavior in the prisons as well?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct, and it depends on the kind of treatment. Some of the cognitive restructuring treatment, for example, that is part of typically the alcohol and drug treatment that people are going through, where they're trying to come to grips, and obviously the presentation in March will talk more about the effectiveness of those programs, but people are trying to come to grips with their thinking errors, and you're trying to get them to address their thinking errors. Some of that, for a number of individuals, is workbook driven. I mean, they meet in groups, but they've got workbook assignments and things that they've got to go through to kind of move them through that process. That's hard to do when you have somebody who can't read. So you have to align those interventions to try to move somebody to a reading level that they can actually know how to work through that kind of a program before that program's going to ultimately be effective. And the same could be said for, we've got English as second language issues, obviously, in the system. And so getting cultural competent treatment or language treatment that's appropriate is another one of those kind of factors that can often end up having an impact on whether it's effective or not.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Mr. Williams, that just brought up a question in my mind. So if somebody's in there that has the ICE, I guess they call them now, detainer, so they're going to be deported because they're a most likely Mexican national that's committed a crime. Do you put them through programs or you just wait for them? Or are they just sitting doing time and they're going to go
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I know that factors into where they appear on the wait list, depending on the kind of program. So I don't think it's a universal issue. I think it depends on the kind of programming as to where they actually would fall and what kind of, if it's treatment that's going to be beneficial for our supervision of them during the period of time that they're in, I think we probably are giving it to them because we think it's ultimately going to keep them engaged and make it a safer institution in which to operate.
Ms. Williams, I know we're running out of time, but this discussion might be a good time for you to just spend a minute or two talking about the Oregon accountability model and how what happens to offenders once they come into the system.
Yeah, and I'm happy to reference that. It was early in the presentation book, and I probably skipped over it because of time constraints to some degree last time, but we do have a process when everyone who comes into the Department of Corrections typically goes through our intake facility at Coffee Creek, both men or women, and they spend on average about a month there. And during that period of time, there is a whole battery of assessments that are done, both medical, mental health,
educational assessments and assessments on criminogenic or criminal risk factors that are evaluated as well. And it's based on that package of assessments that ultimately then is built the corrections plan that theoretically operates something like a class schedule or a plan as to where this individual is going to go and the kind of interventions and gets them on then the universal waiting lists for access to these programs over time. Now, you can personally affect your placement on those based on your own behavior. So if for example, the drug and alcohol treatment that we operate in the AIP programs operates only in minimum custody facilities, if your behavior is such, given your conduct, that you can never become a minimum custody inmate based on your own inability to demonstrate yourself safe, you're not going to get access to that treatment because of your behavior. So it is driven to a great degree on the inmate's own willingness to be both participatory and on their behavior. But we do attempt to stage and schedule that. And it's a very complicated set of systems that try to get people the right place at the right time. And then you add to that the limitation on the availability of beds in some of these key categories that we'll talk about when we get our chance to talk about the policy option programs a little bit. That has an impact, obviously, on who gets access to that treatment. And there's just the reality is there's people who need treatment that aren't getting treatment currently in the system. And we're trying to, as you would want us to do, we're trying to prioritize to get the people with the highest risk to recidivate or highest on the list and getting the treatment the most because we think they pose the greatest risk to public safety upon release.
Is there a KPM on the Oregon accountability model, some way to gauge how you're doing, how many plans are being made, or anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we actually view a number of these key performance measures, at least in theory, tied directly to the Oregon accountability model. Everything from the assaults on staff to the misconducts to some that would like to actually focus on some revisions associated with, for example, the performances about how many people are moving on to transition plans that are more qualitative than quantitative. All of that, we think, ultimately ties back into the Oregon accountability model. The last couple of efficiencies that I'd mention, again, on long range, this counselor caseload management is another component of that where we're really focusing our counselors, our institutional counselors' time, again, to move them more to be focused on those with the highest risk to reoffend. We're looking at eventually the development. We currently don't have electronic health records in the department. As we've grown and as the health issues continue to grow, that becomes a continuing problem where we think in the long term the establishment of electronic health record will actually help us increase our efficiencies, lower our overall failure rates or error rates and all the other things that you get out of the benefit of an electronic health record where people are moving back and forth throughout the system. In 2006, I created the Office of Population Management. I think I mentioned this in my presentation on Thursday, but this is really the place where we're developing the unifying issues about how to get the right inmates in the right beds in the right program at the right time, crossing a number of different divisions within the department. And we think that this, in the long run, it really bore out of our strategic initiatives in the 2005-2007 biennium that made us understand that we had a lot of parts of the department all trying to do the right thing, in some places going the wrong direction. And by creating the office, you know, pulling at each other in the wrong direction, the Office of Population Management, we think, is going to help us become more efficient and address that. And then this last one here on the long range is our conversations with a number of companies that are called ESCOs to help us become more energy efficient over time. These companies come in and do an evaluation, help you actually get the new efficient equipment in place and guarantee a payback on the savings associated with your energy savings, and it's an issue that the department's currently exploring. Our more tangible immediate efficiencies for 2007-09 are listed then on page 59 and 60, and those are implementing the kidney dialysis program at Coffee Creek. We now have enough women with kidney failure issues that it's becoming cost-effective for us to move and open a female dialysis unit that will, in a very short period of time, pay for itself and begin to save the department money. We did a similar thing with the males in the department over at the Two Rivers facility outside of Umatilla, where now everyone in the department who has significant kidney issues is housed at that facility, and it saved the department substantial amounts of money. So that's one.
reducing inmate transfers, we believe we can better manage the transfer of the inmate population through the department and effectuate savings by doing that in this upcoming biennium. We're redesigning the IMU, the intensive management, and the DSU disciplinary segregation units at the penitentiary, reutilizing bed space differently. Also, this ties into our plan for better supervision of the mentally ill population that end up in these kinds of settings. We believe that will show some savings in this next biennium. We've been paying some money, a surprising amount to me, I guess. It's not a lot of money for budget purposes, but it's in the six-figure plus numbers for people to come in and actually clean the hoods in our kitchens. I suspect that Representative Cameron knows something about how this works in the restaurant business, but we have companies that are coming in and doing that, and we believe that we can create inmate employment, have the right staff person with inmates who can travel around the department and actually perform that service and save the department more than six figures in a biennium by actually performing that service inside and not having to hire it out and train some inmates in a possibly career-useful sort of way. And then we're looking at requiring, again, because so much of our budget is in the institutions division, implementing this alert system that I mentioned before, redesigning some of our gang management models, our management of both overtime and vacancy savings, changing agency. Okay, that was the institutions division. I'm sorry, on page 60, we're moving to an electronic staff timesheet. Currently, all 4,000-plus employees in the department are doing these by hand, and then they have to be keyed into our payroll system. So we believe that there's efficiencies associated with moving the department over to an electronic timesheet and are planning for that. And then energy efficiency that's going to be derived by a number of deferred maintenance issues that we've identified in our deferred maintenance projects. So that walks you through the quality improvement piece. I know I'm out of time, Mr. Chair. We haven't gone through a review of the policy option packages, but if it would be, if I could request it, the chair, maybe what we would do, since each of these is going to be brought up into divisional presentations, we just wait to discuss the policy option packages as they come up in each of the division's presentations.
Yeah, that would be fine with me.
Okay.
Senator Westland.
Logistics for tomorrow, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, 245 in front of the Capitol. Sure, the department have a van waiting there, probably all two vans, okay, and then we would return by 5 o'clock. It would be helpful to find out how many members are planning to attend. Okay, everyone that's here then. Okay, so be a pretty full house, and your staff has been given the staff people that are going to
good.
Do the background checks.
Great.
If I could just add, I've been really delighted with the input from the committee. So I think as we continue to go through your budget, it wouldn't surprise me if it ended up taking a couple more days than we currently have scheduled. So you might want to just let your staff
Know that. They'll be delighted to hear that, I'm sure, Mr. Chair. There's a groan emanating from the dome building even as we speak, I'm sure. But, no, we obviously are here to answer any questions the committees have. I know that the questions that have been raised today are being noted, and we'll attempt to get back to the individual members specifically with specific questions and make sure that the professional staff has that information as well for dissemination to the broader committee members.
Like all of the anything that the individual gets to also be disseminated to the committee.
Great.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I sent out a sort of a DOC tour guide on Friday. Please follow that. For example, no blue denim, or you may be staying for an extended period of time.
No pocket knives, no handcuff keys.
No wire bras. Seriously.
I would encourage you, I mean, just, and we can certainly secure everything before we go into the facility, but keys, cell phones, any personal, and in this day and age, I just have to also remind people that, you know, if you have a personal carry permit, if you've got your handcuff key, like Representative Barker for his quick escape artist routine, I just encourage you to make sure that you try to just leave all of that if you can before you come. We will certainly secure any of your personal effects before we go inside the facility in the superintendent's area.
The concern, though, is that will slow us down for a relatively short period of time because it will take a little while to get checked in and checked out.
And Mr. Chair, just if I could just indulge quickly, my intent tomorrow was to focus our visit
on, you know, kind of quickly into the penitentiary, show a couple of the larger housing unit areas so you have a sense of kind of what we do there. Also focus on the mental health and the medical area, which are pretty close at hand to that area, and then show you a little bit on the deferred maintenance issues while we have you there. It wasn't my intent, given the time we had, to necessarily take members all the way down to either the industries area or to the death row and intensive management unit area, just because of the distance that we'd have to travel and the short time we've got. For anyone who would like to see that and would like to extend either their tour tomorrow, if you don't want to come back to the Capitol at 5, we'll be happy to give you the extended version of the tour while you're there and show you everything you want to see, or at any period of time that you have an interest in not only this facility but any other facility in the department, arrange a separate time to show you anything that you'd like to see and to take you into any of the facilities. So, and most of you I've been inside with at some point in time. Representative Nathanson, I think you're the only one that I haven't actually, I think, at some point been on a tour with. So if there are things at the penitentiary we're not showing you tomorrow that you'd like to see more of, we'd be happy to arrange that either tomorrow or on another day.
And I did not hear back from anyone that wanted to extend to enjoy Chef Pierre's food.
We'd be happy. We're going to be late enough that we could certainly sit in on a dinner if any of you'd like to have a meal at the institution. We'd be happy to make that arrangement for you as well. We'd probably go over and meet and eat at the minimum, as we have on some of the lunch trips that we've made before. But if you're interested in having dinner at the facility, given the most recent issues on food, I'm finding I'm eating more of it lately, and I'd encourage you, if you'd want to come and sample it with me, we'd be happy to have you come do that.
Metaphorically. Anything else? Goodness meeting this church.